From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, a Wisconsin Watch reporter speaks on a report that shows police are called on students in Wisconsin at twice the national rate. Mental health correspondent Elisa Roth shares some of the challenges youth at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake face.
Even before COVID complicated everything, it was very, very hard for families to visit. And we know that having people, especially kids, stay connected to their communities is really the best way to make sure they do well when they get out.
We'll learn about 529 saving plans and how they can help young people see a path to higher education.
Even having an account set up, it doesn't have to be a Kelrod. It just sends the message to that child that somebody is invested in their future and it's something that's attainable.
Plus, a new exhibit at Jewish Museum Milwaukee explores the history of the scrap industry. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. We'll start with a report from the Wisconsin Watch. They found that public schools in Wisconsin called the police on students at twice the national rate. Policing in schools disproportionately affects students with disabilities and students of color. Wisconsin was ranked the highest in referring Native students to law enforcement. Leaders Igniting Transformation, or LIT, has advocated for police to be removed from schools. This past year, their action led to the Milwaukee Public School Board ending their contracts with the Milwaukee Police Department. Lake Effect's Mallory Chang spoke with Claire Amari, a reporting fellow at Wisconsin Watch. She also spoke with Michelle Drain, a high school fellow with Leaders Igniting Transformation.
So thank you so much, Claire and Michelle, for being here on Lake Effect with me to talk about this really important issue within the Milwaukee and Wisconsin community about policing in our schools. And Claire, you are on the Wisconsin Watch team, and the Wisconsin Watch recently released a report detailing how in the state of Wisconsin, the police were called on students at two times the national rate and at the highest for Native students. Could you tell me about your reporting? Why is this disproportionately happening in Wisconsin?
Sure. So nationally, about 4.5 students are referred to law enforcement for every 1,000 students enrolled. What we found is that in Wisconsin, that number is actually double. So there are 9 students referred to law enforcement for every 1,000 enrolled. And unfortunately, when you get to minority groups, those rates go up even more. Black students are referred almost 3 times as often as white students. That's a higher rate in all but 4 other states. And as you noted, Native students are referred over 3 times as often as white students, and that's the highest rate of any state in the country. Now, I'm not a Native Wisconsinite. This was surprising to me. I don't think that, you know, nationally, we think of Wisconsin as a place where educators and administrators are quick to turn to the police when there are disciplinary issues at school. But, you know, the data suggests that at least in some school districts, that's what's going on. And there are a lot of reasons that this could be the case. One thing that I definitely found seems to contribute is that many schools simply don't have the resources they need to handle disciplinary issues in-house. So the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction also maintains data, and that shows that the ratio of students to staff services like counselors, psychologists, social workers, nurses, that ratio is much higher than the national organizations recommend for a school. So in other words, you know, staff that could intervene and maybe de-escalate these disciplinary problems or even prevent them from happening in the first place, the staff just isn't there. And the advocates I talked to were really adamant that what that comes down to is funding, you know, that Wisconsin and other states spend more money on student resource officers. And instead, that should go to bringing in counselors, bringing in social workers, bringing in nurses. These are the people that we know make schools safer, and they're the ones that the funding really needs to be channeled to.
What I also found really interesting and very eye-opening within your findings, too, that school officials also called the police on students with disabilities at a very alarming rate as well. Why do school officials do that? You kind of alluded to it, but why is the initial response in working with students with disabilities to call the police?
Well, I think broadly speaking, it can be more difficult to handle disciplinary issues with students with disabilities for a variety of reasons, and not everyone is equipped to do that well. You know, I spoke with Disability Rights Wisconsin, and they said, you know, that it's not uncommon that you're going to find a situation where a student with disabilities becomes overwhelmed, they refuse a directive from a teacher, And then they start to communicate their distress in physical ways. You know, they become tense, maybe a table gets turned over. The issue is that when you bring in the police officer, all of a sudden that's treated like a crime and not what it is, which is really a learning challenge. And of course, the problem is that, you know, as we know, you know, the earlier a student interacts with police, the more likely it is that they will then interact with police again as an adult. It's just a situation that snowballs. So it's very troubling when these things happen.
And we have Michelle on the line too, who you are a high school student and activist with Leaders Igniting Transformation, or also known as LIT. What is the day-to-day impact of police presence in schools, and why is the organization advocating against policing in schools?
So I have the opportunity of not having metal detectors when I first walk in the building. We don't really have a big police presence, but when we do, like the contracts we ended with MPD, some contracts were to monitor our social medias. That is a really big deal. And whenever we would see police officers, that would be because of it, because like they seen a post about a fight. We would see about 5 police cars coming up to school just because of one post about a fight that never happened. It's really not what you want to see when you first walk in the building. We have safety assistants everywhere. They're not really police, but they are supposed to break up fights and help with altercations that might prevent us from learning. But from my experience, they don't really do much in schools. Also, they don't really create relationships with students. From my experience, they lock our school bathrooms during classes to prevent students from leaving class, which is very unethical because we should be able to use the bathroom whenever you want. And they also do hallway sweeps, which is basically if you're late to class, you get caught in a hallway sweep and they'll put everybody in the auditorium and call your parents saying, oh yeah, your student was late to class, which is wasting more class time. We should be there for education. And for LIT, we have our high school campaign is the Invest and Divest, which is basically divesting in police officers, metal detectors, suspensions, and expulsions, while investing in inclusive school dress codes, restorative justice practices in citywide classrooms, even just in professional development classes with teachers. Also having more licensed support professionals like therapists, social workers, and psychologists. And also reducing class sizes. There's many more to that invest in freedom that we advocate for in LIT and divesting from the metal detectors and police officers.
Yeah, and LIT has publicly advocated for racial equity in schools, and especially most recently, Michelle, you talked about this a little bit, with ending the contract between Milwaukee Public Schools and the Milwaukee Police Department. What did it take to end that contract?
Well, I wasn't in LIT at that time, but I think it is really important that we did end those contracts. As being a Black woman in an MPS school, I'm constantly put aside, especially when it comes to learning and just criminalized. I'm just always profiled and assumed and discriminated against in schools. That shouldn't happen. I should be there for my education. And it's also really important for immigrants or people that are not legal citizens, and also for people who want to create a safe haven at our school, especially that most of our Milwaukee public schools, we advocate for people mostly in the 53206 area. And I live on the north side, so I know like a lot of the students, we all go to MPS because that's public school and they're all close to in our neighborhoods. And I feel like it should definitely be advocated more, and we shouldn't have to see police in our front yard and then see them at school again, you know. And we should just simply be there for education, and we shouldn't be swamped by and harassed by police.
And most recently, LIT has spoken against the Common Council President and 2nd District Alderman Cavalier Johnson, who recently said that he wanted funding from the American Rescue Plan to hire more police officers after an incident at Madison High School. LIT has said no, they don't want that. They've disagreed. You've all disagreed with his statement. With this year, with the contract ending, how has school shifted since the ending of this contract?
Personally, I haven't seen much of change. This is my junior year, and you know, with COVID, there hasn't really been much time to see the change, especially with the contracts finally ending over the past 2 years, 2018. So, like I said, our school doesn't go through metal detectors daily. Some of my friends go to Riverside. They go through metal detectors daily, and they also have to turn in their phones at the beginning of the day and get them back at the end of the day, which is wasting more class time during 8th hour, like just to get your phone back. and wasting time like going through metal detectors. A lot of schools still have their metal detectors. And we still have schools that have part-time nurses. A nurse shouldn't be part-time, you know? We need more nurses and health professionals in our building, and psychologists and mental health professionals too.
Claire, I just want to ask, based on your reporting, and Michelle helped to contextualize a little bit as a current student in high school, how can school administrators and those who are interested and invested in ending policing in schools, how can people use this information?
Well, first of all, I would direct them to Wisconsin Watch's website, wisconsinwatch.org. We have a table with all the Wisconsin school district data available to be searched. And you can sort the school district according to category, even, you know, what districts had the highest number of referrals, what districts had the highest number of referrals for Black students or Native students or disabled students, you know, or Latinx students, that's all there. And if you do see your school district high up on the list, I would certainly suggest contacting the district to learn more. One thing we did find doing this reporting is that the data is self-reported. That means that the schools themselves are deciding what counts as a law enforcement referral and sending that to the Department of Education. And we found that the definition of law enforcement referral really could vary pretty wildly between districts. So sometimes it was exactly what it sounds like, that a student is referred to the police department for a disciplinary issue. Sometimes it was something less serious, so just a conversation with the school resource officer or even outreach to a social worker. So I would ask questions. I would try to find out, you know, first of all, what the school district's policy is around police referrals. You know, when are students referred to the police and how does that play out? What resources are available to de-escalate disciplinary issues rather than referring them to the police? And when those don't work, how often do referrals result in charges? I spoke with administrators at one school where they referred, in the sample year that the data comes from, they referred a high number of Native students to the police. And, you know, we asked why that was and what they were doing to try to solve the problem. And they said, you know, really what we're trying to do is come up with more culturally sensitive interventions and build a stronger relationship between the school district and the tribe. You know, and that seems to be a theme for how schools can, one way in which schools can work to resolve this problem. Our hope is that the data is going to provide a window into schools' disciplinary practices and a basis for parents and educators to ask questions.
Claire Amari is a reporting fellow at the Wisconsin Watch, and Michelle Dreen is a high school fellow with Leaders Igniting Transformation. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. Tomorrow, WUWM, in partnership with American Public Media, will host Call to Mind Live, Youth Incarceration and Mental Health. At the event, people who were incarcerated when they were young will share their experiences and how it impacted their mental health. Mental health advocates will also talk about the work being done in Wisconsin's youth prison facilities to address these needs. One of those facilities is Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. The state's deadline for closing the facility has passed, and it's not clear when it will be shut down or what the alternatives will be. There are unique mental health challenges for the young people being housed there, and American Public Media's mental health correspondent, Elisa Roth, explored some of those ahead of the Call to Mind event. She joins me now to talk more about what she's learned. Elisa, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So the facilities at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake have been open for quite some time, you know, since 1970, but things have changed there over the last 50 years. So what does it look like now, today?
Okay, so for starters, there are a lot fewer kids being held there. Even 20 years ago, there were more than 800 people there. As of last week, there were 49 boys and 12 girls, so just over 60 kids total. There are a lot of reasons for that, but probably the biggest is that we've just seen an overall drop in the number of incarcerated youth all across the country. And that, of course, is a good thing. The other thing is that there have been a lot of changes in the wake of the various scandals and lawsuits at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, but I know we're going to talk about that in a bit.
For sure, yeah, and we could totally have a different conversation on that topic alone. But before we get to some of those points, I do want to get into the makeup of the youth who are held at these facilities. So where are most of them from?
The vast majority, like half of them, are from the Milwaukee area. Dane County, so Madison and Kenosha County, are distant second and third. And then the rest are a smattering from the rest of the state. This is important, though, because, as you know, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake are a good 3 hours plus drive from Milwaukee. So even before COVID complicated everything, it was very, very hard for families to visit. And we know that having people, especially kids, stay connected to their communities is really the best way to make sure they do well when they get out. So part of all the talk about where to send these kids once Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake are finally shut down is to find ways to keep them closer to home.
So you did mention scandals and lawsuits. So can you remind listeners briefly what was going on there?
Well, we could talk about this for hours, but it was a mess on a number of fronts, from the mental health staff to the ways that the kids were being treated to just the state of the facilities. From people I talked to, there was also really a sense that Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake were being operated very much as correctional facilities. One of the people I talked to is Orisa Washington. She's a psychologist who worked there until last summer. And she says that when she started back in 2016, she really didn't see the kids very often.
You see certain clients like once every month. You see certain clients once every 2 weeks. Almost very reflective of like the adult or corrections population.
Another psychologist who used to work there told me his client load was so high that even if he had spent all day, every day seeing clients, he never would have made it through all of them in a week. And of course, he never had that much time to see clients. Kids were also regularly punished by being put into solitary confinement for really long stretches. Officers would use pepper spray on them. There were a number of consequences when all these things started coming to light. There was a multi-year federal investigation that actually ended without any charges. But there was also a class action lawsuit that the Wisconsin ACLU and the Juvenile Law Center filed, and that resulted in a federal monitor being put into place to keep an eye on things. And there were a number of other lawsuits, too, that were filed on behalf of kids who'd been held there, and those have cost the state millions of dollars.
So the facilities were supposed to be shut down in July of this year, which was already on top of an extension. But following all of these events that brought these conditions to light, what do things look like these days as these facilities remain open for now?
Well, one of the things I mentioned was the federal monitor. She's been coming in since January of 2019. So we're coming up on, 3 years. Her last report came out in July, back when the facilities should have been shut down. She talked about, in that report, she talked about things getting better overall, but she's still worried about a number of things, including the use of solitary confinement. One of the things the class action settlement did was to seriously limit how solitary can be used there. And one of the lawyers from the Juvenile Law Center, her name is Kate Burdick, she told me that she and her colleagues are worried about how solitary is still being used.
But our concerns are that they may be using it when it's not a concern about self-harm, and it's not a serious self-harm, or it's nothing imminent.
And that in particular, you know, finding ways around solitary confinement is something that we see both in juvenile and adult facilities all over the country and have for a long time. It's also probably worth reminding listeners here that solitary confinement is really hard on people's mental health. It can make symptoms of mental illness much worse in people who have it, but it can also even trigger symptoms in people who didn't have them before.
Right. And on top of that, we're talking about youth mental health, which is also something that has specific needs. And you talked about how few mental health services were there in the facility before. Has that aspect of it improved? What is it like now?
You know, my caveat before I really answer that is that it's always hard to tell from the outside what things really look like on the inside. And the federal monitor doesn't address mental health care in and of itself in her reports because mental health was only tangential to the issues the class action lawsuit looked at. But Orisa Washington, the psychologist who left this summer, said things were much better by the time she left. She said that mental health staff were really involved in all aspects of the kids' lives. And that's similar to what I heard from Tracy Johnson, who heads psychological services there.
From the moment the youth arrives, we assign them a clinician, so that psychology staff member will follow them throughout their stay at the facility, and that will be their individual therapist.
Tracy Johnson told me that there are now 16 mental health staff. One of the things that's happened is that the number of clinicians has stayed about the same, even though the number of people being held there has fallen tremendously. So it's actually really helped the caseload and the staff-to-client ratio.
You know, there are so many issues and challenges that we see at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. So on top of what we've discussed, what else did you see? What stood out to you?
I mean, as you said, there are so many challenges. One of the things that we haven't talked about, which is really a big systemic challenge, but important nonetheless, is the racial disparities. Wisconsin is one of the worst in the country for racial disparities in its correctional system, both at the adult and juvenile levels. There's a very disproportionate number of African Americans and Native Americans being held in the prisons. Arisa Washington, the psychologist who left this summer, is African American, and she talked to me about how few African Americans there are on staff in any capacity at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. And she talked about how important she felt it was for the kids to see and to talk to a person who looks like her. The other big question is what comes next?
Well, exactly. So what does come next?
So as you said earlier, there was actually a law signed back in 2018 that said Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake were supposed to shut down last summer. That obviously didn't happen, and it's really not clear when it will. Part of the challenge there is figuring out where these kids are going to go once these facilities are shut down. There's a push to build facilities closer to the cities where kids can go, but that costs money, obviously. And overall, a lot of people would just like to see these kids getting care in the community in such a way that they can stay living at home.
So as these facilities have remained open, I'm curious, you know, even pending an eventual shutdown, based on the conversations you've had with people who had or are currently working at these facilities, is their commitment to offering better support for these kids there, whether it's mental health or other accommodations at these facilities, does that remain steadfast despite an uncertain future, not knowing whether they're going to be shut down or not?
Yeah, in talking to people, it really felt like things are moving forward there in terms of taking care of the kids. They've recently brought in a specialist to teach staff and kids how to use something called DBT, dialectical behavior therapy. It's a specialized therapy that helps kids respond to a whole range of scenarios, and it requires that all the staff, as I understand it, that the whole staff, whether it's teachers or therapists or anybody else, really understand how this therapy works, and help the kids engage with it. So there's definitely a sense that things are moving forward.
Has there been anything else that stuck out to you as you were reporting this story?
You know, it sounds crass when we're talking about children's lives, but money was a really big one. The state has spent literally millions of dollars to settle these many, many lawsuits that have come up. And no matter what you think about these facilities, you know, whether they should exist or not and how they're doing and all the rest, they're really expensive to run. Under the budget for fiscal year 2022, counties pay the state $1,154 a day per kid. That's more than $400,000 a year. You multiply that by the current population, and we are talking about a lot of money.
Well, you and I both know the stories surrounding these facilities are by no means done and over, but listeners can keep an eye out for your report during Morning Edition tomorrow. And you mentioned the DBT training. We'll also be having a DBT certified therapist on our Call to Mind live event on Wednesday to talk about what that is in these facilities and how people can learn more about it. So in the meantime, Elisa, I want to thank you so much for joining me today and sharing your work.
Well, thank you for having me.
Elisa Roth is the mental health correspondent for American Public Media. She joined me ahead of our event, Call to Mind Live, Youth Incarceration and Mental Health, which will take place Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. You can find information on how to attend at wuwm.com/calltomindlive. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll learn about a new exhibit at the Jewish Museum Milwaukee called Scrapyard, Innovators of Recycling. But first, we'll learn about 529 saving plans and how parents in Milwaukee can start a college fund for their kids with as little as $25. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. For many families, higher education can be out of reach because of the financial burden it puts on the student and their parents. But a 529 saving plan could help make college a reality. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel recently published a series of stories explaining 529 plans and exploring the potential for broader child savings plans. WUWM has been partnering with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee PBS, and the Milwaukee Public Library on an initiative we call Listen MKE. The latest event focused on 529 saving plans and how they work and how parents can access them. The event took place last Thursday on Facebook Live and was hosted by Journal Sentinel reporter Ashley Lutheran. She was joined by Ashley Eckerson, the program manager for Fund My Future Milwaukee, and Linda Lambert, the financial capability director for the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions, who starts by explaining what a 529 saving plan is.
So it's a college savings program, and it's used to set aside funds, not unlike a retirement 401k plan. So it's tax deductible. In 2021, the amount is up to the first $3,380 per beneficiary per account for individuals that are married and filing jointly. Otherwise, it's $1,690 if you're filing individually. So it's a tax advantage, tax deduction upfront, plus the dollars will continue to grow, and they grow tax deferred, and they are not taxed if you use them for qualified higher education expenses at the time that you start withdrawing those funds. So that includes tuition, room and board, fees, computers for school. And then in Wisconsin, earlier this year, we adopted the SECURE Act, the Federal SECURE Act of December 2019. And that allowed a broadening of the qualified expenses. So now you can use 529 funds to also, for the cost of apprenticeship, you can use it towards K through 12 tuition. And you can also use it for a one-time up to $10,000 payback for a student loan. And that can be used for the beneficiary or the beneficiary sibling. So it's really pretty broad use of the funds. And it's just really an advantage. So just starting early, starting and setting up recurring contributions and setting them up, setting the habit, we always say, set it and forget it. You know, if you, whatever you can afford, and setting that recurring contribution is just really important. And you can, again, just watch it and forget about it and watch it grow.
And let's talk a little bit about accessibility. What plans are available within the state of Wisconsin, and how can people access them?
Yep. So Wisconsin offers two college savings programs. We have one, it's EdVest, which most people are probably more familiar with. EdVest is our direct plan. And what that means is individuals can just go online to edvest.com and fill out a very short application. It's very simple. And you can set it up as an individual. Anyone who's 18 years or older can set up the account. You can set it up for yourself. You know, a lot of people are changing careers. You can use those dollars for your own retooling and going back to school. So setting up an account is very simple. So you can either use our direct plan, EdVest, or we have a second plan. It's called Tomorrow Scholar, and that is available directly through registered investment advisors or broker dealers. And so if you are somebody who works with a financial advisor or wants a little more advice, Tomorrow Scholar is a very appropriate option for you. So there's no fees on maintenance fees. There's no annual fees. The only fees, and they're very low, are on some of the investments, that the underlying investments. So there's very low fees on both plans.
Part of the reason this has a wider community impact is not just do we want kids to succeed and get education and, you know, go on to have impactful careers and, you know, solid incomes to support their families. It's also important for all of us and for Wisconsin's economy to have people who are prepared for the jobs of today. I would say of the future, but really it's of today. And in your opinion, Linda, you know, sometimes we hear, well, not everyone is college bound. How would you address concerns from parents who are thinking, oh, I'm not sure if my child's going to go to college. I'm not sure if college is going to be the right thing, or maybe it's not the right thing for me as I'm setting up this account. How would you answer some of those concerns?
Yeah, so people always ask that question. And as I mentioned earlier, it doesn't have to be restricted in terms of if you set up an account for a child, the beneficiary can change. So you can, it can actually be changed to anyone in your own family or to an immediate like a first cousin. It can be transferred to. You can also use it for yourself. Other people also have said, I didn't use everything in my account. I saved it for my child when I had kids. So you can always transfer that beneficiary. There's never any restriction, and it can be changed multiple times. I just want to also share a couple, I think, very meaningful statistics. So there was a study that was done a couple of years ago, Washington State University in St. Louis. And it basically said that, you know, if an account is set up for an individual, so a child who has an account, even with as little as like $500 in the account, it increases the expectations of that child that they're going to go to college by like 25%. And it increases the likelihood that they will graduate by nearly 64%. So I think the value in setting up those an account for an individual just really changes the whole mindset, which to me, I think is really important. The other thing, you know, having even, and it doesn't always have to be a four-year college degree, but anyone among having post high school education, there's a 50% lower unemployment rate. You have higher earnings potential having even just some higher education. So there's a lot of reasons to consider it. I always go back to, you know, just even having an account set up, it doesn't have to be a lot. It just sends the message to that child that somebody is invested in their future and it's something that's attainable. So it's something for them to think about and consider. So it really talks about changing the mindset of individuals.
We're going to turn now to Ashley with Fund My Future Milwaukee. We just heard about some of the state administered 529 plans, and EdVest is a key partner with Fund My Future Milwaukee. Could you tell us a little bit about what the program is and what the goal is?
Sure. So we are actually the 529 omnibus account for the city of Milwaukee. So we are the children's savings account for the city of Milwaukee, where we allocate $25 worth of seed money for all K-5 kindergartners within our participating cohort schools.
And how did this program come about?
Sure. So in 2014, Mayor Tom Barrett had a growing prosperity plan. Out of that plan, we were tasked out of the Department of Administration to figure out a way that we can both increase economic mobility, but also, increase, a workforce, a strong secondary or 21st century workforce. And so with that, there came some technical assistance and you know, focus groups and really a lot of community members that saw that there was a need and figured out that this 529 account was the best way to go.
And Linda cited some of the statistics, but what does the research tell us about these broad-based, either community-based or statewide children's savings account programs?
Sure. That really was what the foundation of our program was based upon, was, you know, knowing that just in general, having the support around these students. Milwaukee is a great city where we provide a lot of wraparound services for our youth and their families when it comes to obtaining education and finding financial support, even in the workforce, being able to help parents. And so I think this program is no different. And then, you know, parents that are interested in learning about a 529 account, what does that even mean? What does savings mean? So we also take in the value of being able to educate our parents on, you know, what it means to save.
And I know that financial literacy, you were talking about working with parents, educating them on savings and what 529 plans are. But I also know financial literacy for students, even as young as the kindergartners, is also a key component of this program. Could you share a little bit about those efforts and what they look like in the classroom?
Sure. I think when I first said that I work with five-year-olds, people were a little surprised, being that they are five. And it's such a topic that, you know, even some of us adults have a hard time wrapping our brains around with you know, gaining education, how expensive education can be. And so with that, I really had to look deeper into what is the message here. And I think overall, even for us visually, it's just, what do you aspire? I remember as kids, they used to ask us what we want to be when we want to grow up. And it gave us that that vision to say, okay, from this moment on, you know, this is something that I want to work towards. And then knowing that everyone around me knew what my goals were, you know, and some of you knew how to obtain that. And so you were able to guide me in that direction. And so that's actually one of the activities that we do, where we talk about with each of our students, what is it that you want to be, and just make that known, known to not only yourself, but to your teachers, to your fellow classmates, to your families when you go home, but really just creating that imagery for everybody. So one of those activities is drawing what they want to be when they grow up. And then we turn those 8x11 sheets of paper into paper graduation caps. And so that they understand the message is that in order for me to be what's at the top, I need to graduate first. And so that's something that we take into consideration. The other thing is we talk about what is college. We think a lot of kids know, you know, about school, but specifically college. Some of them live in areas where they are right by UW-Milwaukee, or they are by Marquette University in the city, and don't know that they live right by a college campus. And so those are some conversations that we have as well. And again, with that support, I talk about my college experiences, some of their teachers share theirs, but it opens a conversation for them to identify like, okay, you know, there are people around me that I see every day that have done this, you know, gone to secondary education of any kind. And then we also talk about what is savings, but for them, it's more of, you know, learning that something of value can start small and grow big. And that's really what the 529 account is.
Ashley Eckerson is the program manager for Fund My Future Milwaukee. Linda Lambert is the financial capability director for the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions. They joined Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Ashley Lutheran for the latest installment of Listen MKE, which focused on 529 saving plans. The event took place on Facebook Live last Thursday, and you can find the full conversation at WUWM.com. Listen MKE is a partnership of WUWM, the Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee Public Library, and Milwaukee PBS. Next, we'll learn about a new exhibit at the Jewish Museum Milwaukee that explores the evolution of the scrap industry and what we can learn about living sustainably today.
The scrap industry affects everything that we handle, everything that we touch, everything that we come into contact with. Every item can be broken down into raw materials that can be reused, reprocessed, recycled.
That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Jewish Museum Milwaukee has a new exhibit that is meant to get people thinking about how to live sustainably. It's called Scrapyard, Innovators of Recycling. It shows visitors the history of scrap recycling and the vast industry it is today, which was largely influenced by Jewish immigrant families. The main exhibit was created by Jewish Museum Maryland, but here in Milwaukee, the museum also gathered stories and artifacts from some of Wisconsin's early scrap businesses. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz got a look at the exhibit, guided by Jewish Museum Milwaukee curator Molly Dubin. She started the tour in front of a motorbike.
Really, the scrap industry affects everything that we handle, everything that we touch, everything that we come into contact with, and that every item can be broken down into raw materials that can be reused, reprocessed, recycled. Hopefully the majority of it, some cannot, depending on what the material is. So here we have this motorbike, and it shows you the finished product, but it breaks it down for you into, it's made of aluminum, plastic, rubber, alloy, steel, and all of those things have different uses and are processed and handled in different ways. So I think that's a good reminder of our connection. And that's really one of the main things that we were excited about, is to really help with the discussion and the education. Certainly there's huge movements in terms of sustainability and green and all of these things that are so necessary to helping us continue to take care of our environment, better our environment, and to hopefully keep things out of landfills and to show us what our role is in the chain, that we're not so far removed. In fact, we're really at the center of everything. And to be more mindful once you go through the exhibit and kind of see everything that's involved and certainly the longevity and significance of this industry, that we need to be aware. You know, what are we purchasing? What are the raw materials that it's made of? How is it packaged? Where are these things ending up? And being conscious of that knowledge and choices that you make. During, you know, the height of kind of immigration, the late 1800s, early 1900s, when you have this huge influx of people coming from Eastern Europe, they are looking for a means of, supporting themselves, their families. And for many minorities, many Jewish, which for half of the 20th century, nearly 70 to 90% of the industry was Jewish. And that's not by chance. I mean, there were other minorities. There were, you know, a great deal of Italian immigrants that were involved in the industry. But for Jewish individuals, many times it was out of necessity because other opportunities weren't available to them. And if you were a peddler, you could come into a situation where you needed very little money, very low overhead. You really didn't need to necessarily know the language. And it wasn't something that really existed. So because of that entrepreneurial spirit that we find also as a commonality in many of the immigrants and Jewish immigrants that were coming to the United States, this was something that they could make their own kind of unique niche and develop and grow, which is what they did. I mean, the original peddlers that evolved with time and commodities and technologies and, you know, environmentalism and perception, I mean, these are the pillars of Jewish communities, not just in Milwaukee, but in cities around the Midwest and the entire country. So it really is spread out in terms of the different themes. It does follow some bit of a chronological narrative, going from the peddlers who started out with the carts, the horses, their simple tools, to, you know, moving on to maybe having, you know, a horse and wagon, to then the truck, to, you know, bringing us to where we are today. We also look at the depiction of scrappers throughout history. And there have been some positive, but I would say more negatives and more stereotypes that really play off of things that have infiltrated collective popular culture. There were positives, like early, you know, Yiddish theater shows like Shmatas, which means rags in Yiddish. But there were also very negative depictions, depicting, you know, Jewish individuals who were, you know, scrappers in raggy clothing, as dirty, as lesser than. Some of those physical depictions that we have come to be unfortunately very familiar with, the larger or hooked noses. And this kind of perpetration, this continued to perpetuate the idea also of these individuals and Jewish individuals being untrustworthy to some extent. So, you know, these are all things that we see and have become so woven into culture. I mean, one of the most, you know, more recent depictions, the character Watto, who was, you know, from one of the Star Wars films, Attack of the Clones, he was a scrapper. And he is clearly depicted with a large nose when he talks. It's a very, you know, kind of Yiddish, you know, Jewish accent depiction. And that was something that really received, you know, some negative feedback, and rightfully so. But it just goes to show, to some extent, how far it has, you know, filtered.
So are we now in Wisconsin?
So we're still...
Not yet. I'm just so eager.
So this whole section really looks to early perception, but how that shifts in war times. Scrapping industry was really important after the Civil War, after World War I, and here we really get into looking at World War II.
Read us that.
Junk rains hell on Axis, and it's, you know, a picture of, you know, all of these scrap bits that are raining down that were so important to assisting the U.S. in defeating the evil Axis during World War II. And it was promoted as this kind of patriotic campaign. Everyone, do your part, get involved, you know, victory rallies to collect scrap. And all of a sudden, this stereotype that, you know, is skewed fairly negatively starts to become somewhat heroic. These are just a few examples. To give you an idea, so here's Phil Paley. He worked for Miller Compressing. Great quote. "My mother always tells the story that part of her pleasure was that she would go peddling with her father. They would leave in the morning with the horse and wagon, pack a lunch, and then they would drive out to Waukesha. And they'd peddle, and then it was already dark. They took any scrap they had, and they would throw it in the backyard. And that was somewhat how the scrap business started." This is a backyard. This is the backyard of the family home. And that's where it really began. So here's a case that really has kind of a nice collection of some of the different artifacts that we collected from our community and from our own archives.
The memo book, I love that.
So that was actually, that's part of our permanent collection. That is a notebook written in Yiddish by Irving Porter. His son Jack donated it to us. But I think that's great. As you said, it, you know, really gives you an idea of the connection to the, you know, the history, the identity of some of the people that were involved. And it's right next to a safety manual that at one point was written for Miller Compressing.
So Molly, beyond the importance of what we consume and what is wasted, what else do you want people to walk out of this exhibit thinking about?
I really think it is that awareness, particularly with the e-waste. I think that is something that I did not know a great deal about. And with the knowledge of the extent to which e-technology is so much a part of our culture, our society, being aware of that, I think, is so important. Also, giving people an understanding of these individuals who started it all, and, you know, the difficult backgrounds that many of them came from, the struggles that they went through, things that are, again, parallel to today when you think about, you know, anti-immigrant notions or stereotypes of different individuals. Having an understanding of where some of these phrases or perceptions that are so part of our culture and our vernacular, where they originated from, and the fact that so many are not right, they're not correct. I think that is an important lesson to learn, and it will help people maybe to reflect back on some of the things that they think they knew or had an understanding of, and realize that there's a much greater story at play.
Molly Dubin is the curator at Jewish Museum Milwaukee. She spoke to WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. The Scrapyard, Innovators of Recycling exhibit runs through the end of January with both in-person and virtual options. And that's Lake Effect for today. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow on the show, we'll take you to a frog arena at UW-Milwaukee where researchers are looking into the different sounds of frogs and how it impacts mating. Plus, we'll learn how the city of Milwaukee plans to spend budget dollars, including money received through the American Rescue Plan Act. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.